So when I designed this classroom, I called it Leaning Into Intellectualism. Right, so the idea is to try and see, you know, to have fun intellectually and see where it goes in terms. So we're going to try to do something. You may be better than I am. It's going to be beyond my current competence, although once upon a time, possibly I could have done the philosophy well. I want to do the philosophy. And then I want to do, and that may be all that's reasonable in one session, is to do the philosophy and to set up the problem of importing the philosophy. But ideally, we'll get to do one attempt at applying it. And I should say, like, you know, Fred, I'm being risky. So I tell students a story from a book called The Blackboard Jungle, which is Evan Hunter, I believe, which is a really terrifying book about high school teaching. And the moment for me that's indelible is there's a teacher who, like, his dream is of being an inspirational teacher, but he's a little bit of a geek, and he's not reaching the kids in this inner city school. So he brings in, dating the book, right? He says it's the last thing he's going to bring in his collection of jazz LPs and play them for them, and that's going to be, like, you know, show that they can reach each other's souls, and he's going to be able to teach them. Brings in his LP collection, and the students look at him and say, "Frisbees." So, I'm warning, I'm very, very attached to this. So I have to be kind about it, because this, you know, this would be the equivalent to frisbees. I'm doing it not because I despair, but because it's been really great. So I'm willing to take a chance, and I haven't tried it before, doing it systematically. So also, hopefully there are good positive stakes as well, because if this works out, then this will presumably be turned into something major. Okay, so we're going to start where there's this fellow Immanuel Kant, right, in Germany, the 18th century or something like that, revolutionizes the world in all sorts of ways. One of the ways he revolutionizes the world is ethics. And obviously, you know, people have spent lots and lots of time trying to narrow it down, and I'm not a Kantian, and there are many, many different versions of his philosophy. I tried to take the Britannica, seemed to me to be closest to the way I had understood him and therefore want to use him in a Jewish context. Right? So he's famous for this idea called the categorical imperative. And the way the Britannica famously it's framed as a rule that has no circumstantial exceptions. And the case that always drives people crazy is that Kant says, at least in one place, that if a person gives you a gun and then goes, and then a person asks you to hold a gun for him for safekeeping and then goes insane, and now wants to use the gun to murder people, and comes back to you and asks you for the gun, you have to give it to him. And you certainly can't lie about whether you have the gun, because the rules of not lying and the rules of not stealing, all those things are rules that exist independent of any circumstances. So obviously there are going to be ways out of that, right? Most people are not interested in adopting a set of ethics in place, but that's what we mean by categorical. But the way it's framed, right, is as opposed to hypothetical imperatives, is a categorical imperative is one that is true independent of anything you want to accomplish. It just is. I think, you know, right? The other fancy term for it is deontological, but it has no purpose. It just it just is a value to act this way. Okay, so the Britannica says that there are two ways to formulate Kant's categorical imperative. One is as a principle for rational agency, it's framed as you should always act in the way in which you would want every other rational being to act. And that creates a criteria that's called universalizability. Right? Every statement of ethics you set out, it has to be true for everybody with regard to everybody. And you can see offhand that this is going to cause a problem for Judaism. Judaism makes so we could try and resolve it by saying all the things that are particular to Judaism are not ethical. Right? There are some other, right? There are other values. Right? But it's not at all clear that if you're functioning, halacha doesn't seem consistently to work with the assumption that all actions should be the same towards, right, towards all rational agents, and all rational agents should behave the same way. Right, so that's a stage one contrary. On the one hand, it's like it's a very, I think I find it a very appealing notion that that, you know, ethics that is part definitional to ethics, that it's the same for that it's the same for everybody and towards everybody, but you know, from people playing halacha, it's a challenge. So there's a book called Alternatives in Jewish Bioethics by Israeli philosopher Noam Zohar, where he asks this question very, very directly. He says, it seems like there are people who challenge it. You cannot have Jewish ethics. You can be Jewish or you can be ethical, but you can't have Jewish ethics. It might be you'll have a coincidence that halacha will coincide with ethics a lot. But you can't actually have Jewish ethics because it's not working with the right premises. And we'll see like what the response to that is, right? Why, because Noam Zohar ends up writing a book called Alternative to Jewish, right? Jewish medical ethics, because he thinks, biomedical ethics, because he thinks that it's important to find a way around that, but the critique is fine. Okay, so that's number one, right? Number one is universalizability, that the test of ethics isn't the same for everybody and towards everybody. The second challenge, which I think is much easier to find appealing in Judaism, is this, right, which they call the moral principle, which is to always act to treat human beings, whether yourself or somebody else, right, as an end and not as a means. Right? All human beings at all times have to be treated as ends and not means. Right? You can't use a human being as a way to accomplish something else. So that there are certain things that will prima facie be challenges to that. Probably the most direct challenge to this probably is the Rambam's explanation for the existence of non-philosophers, because the Rambam goes through, you know, the pragmatic purpose of what God has in creating everything in the world, you know, from spiders to other kinds of animals and vegetation and minerals and all that, and he has a trouble. Why does God create non-philosophers? And non-philosophers exist to bring silk clothing to philosophers who understand and appreciate silk clothing, but are not silly enough to risk their lives trying to obtain it. So that's right, so the Rambam has a doubt in the perishable of science, about as instrumental a view of non-philosophers as you can, and that's, you know, so we can set up very starkly, it's Machlokas Kant and the Rambam, and on this one, I would tend to pass from my Kant. Okay, all right, so those are our two starting points, right? Universalizability, which rests on fundamentally identifying human beings as rational agents, right? And that's, and you can certainly, you can, right, human beings aren't exclusively rational agents. You can debate whether human beings' purpose is to be rational agents, and you can talk about how the other aspects of human beings should generate normative behavior, right? That the way you make decisions should not just be based on reason necessarily, right? So his, but Kant is dealing with, you know, assuming that the primary feature for these, right, for determining behavior of human, right, of human beings, at least in the ethical realm, is reason, and that's an interesting challenge. Right, Hume famously says that reason is but the slave of passions that should pretend to be nothing more. right, so you have, right, so you could have a challenge as to whether this is in any way possible. So it seems to me, though, that if you wanted to ground Kant, it's pretty easy to ground Kant in Bereshis, and that you could make the argument, and I guess I am making the argument, that another way of framing it is just to take a particular conception of Tzelem Elokim. Now, whether Tzelem Elokim is reason is a matter of grave controversy, and then what sort of reason? So that's not so easy, right? Because it could be that Tzelem Elokim Dafka doesn't relate to reasoning facility, but relates to some, right, relates to some other kind of facility. It's huge. Machlokas all over the years about what constitutes the Tzelem Elokim, which is becoming much more complicated now by scientific indications that human capacities are not as species exclusive as we used to think they were. Right? That we find more and more animals capable of using tools and capable of engaging in elementary reasoning, like crows, right? Right? So it becomes harder and harder. Caledonian crows, I think specifically, are really good at certain kinds of reasoning. So it becomes harder to make simple statements about what differentiates humanity. I gave a share about this MIT some years ago. I thought it was really good, but I just discovered it didn't come out. Unfortunately, I thought the tape isn't there for all those years, but it turns out I had a blank audio. But I am still strongly committed to human uniqueness, but I think one has to acknowledge that, right, that human uniqueness is not such a, it's not as obvious to say, let's say when Unkelus says, right, that Tzelem Elokim is, that seems to suggest what's unique about human beings is speech, right? But whales are messing that up, right? Right, all sorts, maybe, right? So all sorts of things complicate that. So I think that is more of a challenge. The notion that human beings have to be treated as means rather than ends, I think, is intuitive. We all say that in all sorts of religious contexts, you can't treat God as a means. And the God is an end, right? You can't say, right, that to use God as, you know, in order to get things, is an abuse of religion. And so then it's not so hard to accept to say that, you know, that treating human beings as having that aspect of divinity, that you have to treat human beings as ends in themselves and not as means, that seems to be a more natural extension. What do you guys think?
Makes sense.
Makes sense. Okay, one vote for makes sense. One, well, not quite sure. Okay, so right, so you know, I'm gonna be frank, right? So, you know, after Lantaria, I'm gonna try to, you know, I stake myself on this to some extent. I have to find a way, right? If I want to make a powerful Judaism, I have to find some way to root it. And it seems to me like, you know, about a good definition of what it means. Now, I should also put it exegetically. What Tzelem Elokim means is a mess also, right? Because let's say Rashi, for example, doesn't think it means that we have an image which is like the image of God. He thinks that God owns a mold and he makes us in the mold that he owns. Right? Not the mold that he looks like, but the mold that he owns. So there are lots of, right, the Rambam has, you know, has trouble with any notion of comparison, right? So the Rambam pledges always that all, you know, that he, where he has that line, you know, that any notion that there are things that are true of God primarily and human beings secondarily is false in a category error, right? And assumes that you can ascribe attributes to God, which is totally false. And then he, you know, he says about thought, don't ever say that thought, knowledge instead of God primarily and us secondarily. Really, there's no comparison at all. You might as well, the use of the word ladat in terms of God or idea in terms of God is unrelated, it's a homonym to the use of idea by human beings, and therefore you should use no analogies or anything like that. Then the next chapter gives you an analogy. So that's one of the famous contradictions in the Mora that you have to try and approach. But that also has this notion, right, Tzelem Elokim is problematic if you want to view it as partaking in some way of God. If you think that they're philosophically, you're not allowed to make statements that compare human beings to God. So if you're really a Maimonidean negative theology person, then this would also not work, probably. And yet, it's not at all satisfying to say, let's say, like, so in chapter 2 of the God, I believe it is, right? Chapter 1, which I always love this, right? When I think, I may have realized it on my own, as part of a conversation my friend Gabriel Danzig about particular approaches to Rambam, and this is where one of the things that sort of got me, is that there are the more esoteric approaches that the Rambam tells you there are three meanings of the word Elokim. And if you want to understand anything, you have to know which meaning of the word Elokim is being intended where, right? Is it judge, is it angel, is it God? And he quotes three psukim in the chapter, which use the word Elokim, and doesn't tell you which one is which.
Exercise to the reader.
Yeah, that's what it is, right? But how do you know if you pass? Right? You could be getting every single thing wrong. You could be getting every single thing wrong, so there's always a risk. And then you have, which the Rambam spends a lot of time on, that in Perek Aleph it's, right, it's Tzelem Elokim, and in Perek Hey it's Dmut Elokim, and Perek Bet through Dalet none of that appears at all. And those are all challenges to an approach. Rooting it in Tzelem Elokim means that you're staking yourself in Perek Aleph, and then I didn't put on there, but Perek Tet. Tzelem shows up twice. Right, Dmut shows up once, and then we have the narrative of Ganeden, which has a totally different image. Second, another issue we have to approach is that so in Perek Aleph and in Perek He, it's really clear that you are including women in Tzelem Elokim in the same way, right? The Pesukim are set up in ways that are designed to, right? They're designed to emphasize, right? Vayifra Elokim et Hadam b'tzelemo, v'tzelem Elokim bara oto, zakar nekeva bara otam. Right? That's pretty clear, right? That you're trying to associate the zakar, both the zakar and nekeva are the Adam. You can do that, you know, literally with the androgyne approach. And the zakar and nekeva are separations, but that runs the risk that the tzelem is actually only the two of them together. And neither of them is b'tzelem individually. So I'd rather say that each of them is. Each of them is Elokim. You can see the same, you know, rhythm in Perek He where the end of the lines are Adam, Adam, Oto, Bra'am, Otam, Adam, Ibaram. Right, Ibaram is obviously, you know, it seems obviously constructed to keep the rhyme scheme going. But in the middle you have Oto, and which is singular, which is contrasted again with Zachar Nekeva Bra'am. So I think that in Aleph and He, it's pretty clear that you're going out of your way to make both men and women the same in terms of Tzelem and Demut. But in Perek Bet, it's not all so obvious. You have a narrative. One of the ways to frame it is around the term Ezer Kenegdo, because Ezer can often be constructed in an absolutely anti-Kantian term. That men are the end and women are the means. Right, Kenegdo, if you understand Kenegdo as equal, which is the simplest shot, right? The Kenegdo is a scale, and if you're Kenegdo, it means that you each weight the scale equally. So the two, right? So the two, right? So the two sides of the scale are opposite. So if you understand Kenegdo that way, so it undermines the. You know, undermines the Azer and makes the argument that the Azer Kenegdo means they should be Ozrim to each other. But that certainly is a challenge that has to be addressed, is the extent to which you can root a claim. I don't know how well Kant does it either, but because men and women are not the same, and you don't want women and women to behave necessarily exactly. It's an interesting question whether ethics should be the same for men and women in all circumstances. So I don't know. Then the other thing we'll have to address is I will take very strongly the claim that Tzelem Elokim relates to all humanity at the outset and continues to relate to all humanity, which I think is a simpler pshat, but it would be disingenuous not to acknowledge that the Khuzari the Khuzari himself takes an approach in which he thinks that what any human being has, the vast majority of human beings have, is the capacity to become a Tzelem Elokim, or that's even rare, the capacity to have children who will become a Tzelem Elokim. Right? That's really what the Khuzari thinks is that, right? Is that the Tzelem Adam is a Tzelem Elokim, and then afterwards it is possible for human beings to become a Tzelem Elokim. And then he says, right, this is, you know, the Khuzari's position on converts is very controversial. What he says is that converts can't become the Tzelem Elokim on their own, but they can have children. So they're just like the vast majority of Jews. right? So you can, you know, it's not that frame of the Khuzari, right, is not actually as bad as, you know, from a Kantian perspective as people often. Or whatever perspective you want, from a racial perspective, or maybe as people think it is, because he doesn't think that there's a difference between Jews and non-Jews. He thinks there's a difference between some Jews and the rest of the human beings, and that non-Jews can become that kind of Jew, or their children become that kind of Jew. They're like Jews, right? Children can become that kind of Jew. Anyway, there's also the Zohar, which may even more strongly seem to think that Tzelem Elokim is narrative, although I'm not an expert in Zohar and there are other ways to frame how the Zohar treats the difference between Jews and non-Jews. So I'm going to, with all these caveats, right, and all these caveats have to be addressed in Halakha, I still want to argue, and it's not a chiddush of mine, right, the vast majority of Jewish thinkers who engage with the world, you know, with the modern world, or you basically have to deal with Kant in these ways, and with one other principle of Kant, which is which emerges from all these, is that Kant believes that ethics has to be autonomous, that you can't do things because somebody else tells you to do them. Right? You have to do them, because you want, because you believe that is what you should do. So that also obviously poses a deep problem for halacha, and that's, let's say, among other things, that's what a major part of the Rav's work is designed to try and find a way that halachic obedience is compatible with Kantian autonomy, which perhaps is not as big a deal as it looks up front, because any notion of law is going to require, in any society, right? Kant agrees you have to construct a society. Society is always going to end up in some way subordinating your autonomy to that of a social structure. So which one you do and where, how you relate to the personality of God, but it's doable, we should be aware. Okay. So those are our starting points. Right? Starting point is that I'm going to try and take at least the Kantian moral principle that all human beings have to be treated as ends rather than means. I'm going to try and claim that it's plausible and powerful to say that that's what it means. That's the implication of, or really what it means for human beings to be created in the Tzelem Elokim, and then try and see if that can be reflected in halacha in a way that we find powerful, not forced. Okay. So let us now turn to a Gemara, or it's really three Gemaras. They've all seen before, but because we're going to be staking a lot on it, I want to point out that there are really three Gemaras and not just one. And there are actually subtle differences between them, some of which may really, really matter. Okay, so the first Gemara we're going to start, not doing them in order, or doing them because I think that this is the best way to present them, is a Gemara on Sanhedrin Ein Dalan Aleph, which begins with a statement of Rabbi Yochanan in the name of Shimon ben Yehotzedek, that Nimnu Vigamru Baliat Beit Nitza Belud, that there was a vote, among whom we don't know, but that means we're locating ourselves sometime in the Tannaitic period. That is, now Nimnu Vigamru, so far as I know, never appears as a description of Amoraic times. And Rabbi Yochanan is quoting anyone earlier than him is generally going back to the Tannaitic period. I don't know exactly when Shimon ben Yehotzedek lived, and I don't know how much to trust that Rav Shimon ben Yehotzedek as opposed to Rav Shimon bar Yochai, right? That's obviously something that can shift a lot. All you need is Rashbi, right? And you can, in a manuscript, that's going to get expanded. So I don't know, but, and Beit Nitza Belud locates you in a particular, right, in a particular period, the Avna period, I believe. So Rabbi Yochanan records a tradition from the Tannaitic period, and then generally I think it's assumed that if you're having a vote in an Aliyah Beit Nitza Belud, you're probably during a period of persecution, or at least a period of persecution is highly anticipated. That's why you're often summoned upstairs. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know for sure. That's the way I was taught. I don't know what the current academic consensus about it is. And they said as follows: Kol averot shebeTorah, all the sins in the Torah, imamrin l'adam avor ve'al tehereg, yavor ve'al yehereg. Okay, so all averot, all transgressions, all negative commandments. If they tell a person that you should violate these, so as not to be killed, you're supposed to violate them and not be killed, except for famously the big three: avodah zarah, gilui ariyot, and shfichut dami. Okay. Later we'll talk about like exactly what the boundaries are of avodah zarah, gilui ariyot, and shfichut dami. Right. Obviously, avodah zarah is a catch-all phrase. It includes, let's say, molech. Right. There are other prohibitions, and the Gemara comes to the category called Abizrahu, right, which the only word we can call is penumbra, right? So, right. But penumbra, you know, is a constitutional law term. But Lichtenstein like using it, it's a shadow around a shadow. It's how you distinguish shadim from human beings. The shadim don't have penumbras, they only have umbras. Human beings have penumbras, right? That's the only two places the Gemara uses it. Whatever it may be, right? So, but Azara is some kind of category. Gilar Ayot is obviously a broad category, Shrikut Amim. So framing it as three out of 613 is not correct, because each of these is multiple, and I have to play exactly how many it is. And all of these are categories that also exist in Mitzvot Bnei Noach, which is important to understand. But there seems to be, right, and we don't know We don't know like whether these three are just happen to be the three, or whether they actually represent some kind of border category. Shlichut damim, you know, is about, you know, presumably is some kind of Adam l'chaveru, but the notion of tzelem elokim, right? Certainly, like this is the one that Adam l'chaveru that is clearly the Adam l'makom also. If human beings ever tell Mokim, right, kill a lot, right? And so we don't like it, they don't break out into three neat categories. So we don't know why these three. There's no philosophic justification given. So the Gemara's first reaction is, really? You're not supposed to give in to Avodah Zarah? But Rabbi Shmuel said, Minayin Shimar Mlila the Dam of Avodah Zarah of Al Tere, Minayin Sheyavod Val Yehre, Tabalor Bechaybe, Velo Shemut Behem. Right, so that really, right, so that really works, which is, right, you know, Rishbel thinks that you're supposed to worship Avodah Zarah. Why not? Says v'chai b'hem. Right, it's interesting in its own right because of the famous sugya in Yuma, where they try and figure out how we learn that Safek Pikuach Nefesh is Dilcha Shabbos. It waits till Shmuel and Amora to get to v'chai b'hem. Even though it's here it's already a position of Rabbi Shmuel the Tana that everyone has to try and figure out. Is that because we reject Rabbi Yishmael here, so people don't want to resurrect that pasuk? That was clever, I think, resurrecting the Chayvim. Anyway, as our entertainment moment. okay, so the verse is Yochel Afilu for Hesia. Tamalor v'losuchalu etchem kachi v'nik dashti. Okay, so it turns out that the only avera which is Yehareg v'Yavor is Chilul Hashem. And then later, right, which is not going to be our sugya, people will try and figure out, well, is Chilul Hashem only for Avodah Zarah? Or does it mean doing any avera in public? And in the end, we end up adding any avera in public. But then it depends on the circumstances, why they intended, all things like that. Okay, I just want to point out that it wasn't obvious. Avodah Zarah was controversial. We don't know from this writer what Rabbi Shmuel would think about Gilui Arayot and Shlichut Damim. And maybe he would think that the same is true, that the Chayvim means that there is no imperative that trumps your own survival. Or maybe he would say, no, it's only about Zarah, Gilui Arayot and Shlichut Damim, of course. You can't do. Right? We don't, or he could split them and say, you know, one of the two. Right? We don't know anything about that. Because the Gemara says, no, Rabbi Yochanan was following Rabbi Eliezer, and that gets us into the flow of the sugya that you'll probably recognize. Right? So Rabbi Eliezer says, we have to shem et lekecha b'chol v'cha v'chol nashecha v'chol miyodecha. Why does it have to say b'chol nashecha and b'chol miyodecha? Right? Where the lev fits into this nefesh and ma'od thing is not quite clear. Right? But he thinks that nefesh and ma'od, to some degree, are redundant. The answer is, if yesh lecha adam shekufo chaviv alav mimono, lechach ne'emar b'chol nafshecha, v'im yesh lecha adam shemomono chaviv alav migufo, lechach ne'emar b'chol miyudecha. So the implication seems to be that b'chol nafshecha means to serve God with your whole life. And that's what it means, right? So therefore, we have to say that there might be people who would be more willing to give up their money than their life. So that has to say b'chol miyudecha. There might be people more willing to give up their life than their money, but the answer is you have to give up both your money and your life. Right? That's usually how this is understood. As I already pointed out, one exegetical weakness is it doesn't tell us what a lev is. Right? So what is it you're supposed? Right? There must be a third thing you're supposed to give up in addition to your possessions and your life. Also, it doesn't say explicitly give up your life. It just says bechol nafshecha. Right? The person who says it explicitly is Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva says, "B'chol nafshecha afilu notel et nafshecha." But in our version of the Gemara, Rabbi Akiva doesn't say it here. Rabbi Akiva says it in a different context, which the Gemara in one place brings up after Rabbi Eliezer, in the story in which Rabbi Akiva is being tortured. Right. But our Gemara does not ever quote Rabbi Akiva as the source for Gilui Arayot being. For Gilui Arayot being Yehareg v'Yavor. The Meiri seems to have had a girsa of the Gemara in which it was said, and Rashi on Chumash quotes Rabbi Akiva. Because Rashi on Chumash quotes Rabbi Akiva, we tend to associate it automatically with that, We know the Gemara has it also, and we generally say Alacha ki Rabbi Akiva mechaviro, so we're generally passing like Rabbi Akiva. But it may be significant that that the Gemara, as we have it, and I think as many Rishonim probably had it, that's very hard to prove, thought that we derive it from a different drasha than Rabbi Akiva. Be that as it may, we seem to have an argument that it would be the Bevat Hashem Elokecha means Hashem Elokecha exclusively. But maybe we say Be'adrecha b'chol nafshecha means you can't split it by doing any avodah zarah. And therefore you have to give up your life rather than commit avodah zarah, because that's how the mitzvah of Avas Hashem is framed. Okay, so much for avodah zarah, machlokas between Rabbi Shmuel on the one hand, Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Kiva on the other. Right, about the extent of the mitzvah of Avas Hashem. Then we get to Gili Arayos Hashrichu Tamim. So the Gemara says, when Rabbi Yochanan said that you can't give up your life rather than violate those two, he's following Rebbe, because there's a brayso about Rebbe. So Rebbe quotes a pasuk which says, in the context of adulterous rape, if the woman had no capacity to resist, so it says, right, so she's blameless, right, she's not punished. Ki kasher yakum ish al re'ehu or tzacho nefesh ken hadavar hazeh, right, because being the victim of adulterous rape is like murdering somebody. That's a very odd analogy, right? But that's what the pasukim say, right? As if it's just like when a person, right? So obviously you can get out of it by saying no, it's right. It's like being murdered. But there is a whole halachic debate about whether the formulation of it is separate, and particularly whether women are chayavut, right? Whether we paskin, right? Machloket, whether we paskin that women are chayavut to give up Rehari Valiyav or Angili Arayot. But for our purposes, the Gemara says, V'chim madlamadam yiratzeach. This is, from a halachic purpose, this is not intended to give an explanation. We could say it's explaining, right? You're right, that you are as helpless in this situation as if you were murdered. So it could be explaining that's your guiltlessness, but the Gemara assumes it's here to create a legal parallel that teaches us something we would not have known, not just to give a rationale for the exemption. And so what have we learned from murder, right? What is the legal result in the case of murder that we can extend to the case of Gilei Arayot? As the Gemara says, right, me'at ha'reze b'lala made b'nim salamed. So even though the frame of the pasuk is we're learning something from murder to Gilei Arayot, actually what we're going to do is go the other way around. That's what it should say. Now the problem is the Gemara then goes both ways. Right, then goes the drasha that goes both ways. So trying to figure out how you square this ha'reze b'nim salamed b'balim lovin salamed with the fact that the Gemara ends up giving a drasha both ways is an exegetical challenge. So the Gemara says this, right? So we're going to present that, leave that line, but we'll have to see if we understand it at some point. So me'ata reze bel lamevi him salameid, makish neretzeach l'nara merasa, ma n'ara merasa nitan l'hatzilo b'nafsho, af retzeach nitan l'hatzilo b'nafsho. So the first thing we do is we teach a murder from n'ara merasa, not the other way around. And we say that just as you are allowed to rescue the potential victim of adulterous rape by killing the attempted rapist, so too you can rescue the victim of an attempted murder by killing the attempted homicide. Now, you'll ask me, how do I know that you can save the victim of rape? Because it says, Sakaha na'arava ein moshiela. That implies that somebody could be moshiya. And we derive that they can be moshiya any way possible. Okay, so that's the drasha we get. And then there's also the reverse, which is what matters to us here, which is umakish nara merasa l'rotzeach, ma rotzeach yereg val yavor, af nara merasa yereg val tavor. So in the end, we do get something out of rotzeach. That was an interesting challenge, right, as to how that happened, why we said that harezep balala mevin salamay. Okay, so having at the end decided that in the end we do learn something for Nara Marasa from murder, right? Namely, we learn that Nara Marasa is Yehareg Val Yavor. Our version of the Gemara is Tehareg Val Tavor, but other versions are Yehareg Val Yavor. And again, that depends whether you think it applies to women or men, which is a whole machloket. We've shown them already. So the Gemara says, Raseach Gufei Menala. Right? How do we know that if you're going to derive from the Hekesh, that Nara Marasa is your Hegel Yavor from your prior knowledge that Rotzeach is your Hegel Yavor, Well, how do you know Rasef is Yehari Gali Yavor? So the Gemara answer is, Rasef Gufei Minela on Svaru. Rasef is a Svara, and then it tells you a story. And the story is, Ahuda Atala Kameh D'Rabba, someone comes before Rabba. This is very late, right? Everything else has been Tanidik, and now we're going to tell an Amoraic story, but obviously we have to believe that the Svara pre-existed the story, because the story is, because the premise of Rabbi Yochanan's statement, right? Rabbi Yochanan's two generations before, is a generation before Rabba. The premise of Rabbi Yochanan's statement, which anyway, Rabbi Yochanan's statement is Tanidik, the premise of that statement is that you can derive Naram Rasaf from Rasef, which you already know. So the story is there to illustrate the principle. The Svara. Ha'uda Tala Kameh D'Rabba. So somebody came in front of Rabba, Amarle, and said to him, Amarle Mori D'Roy, my feudal lord said to me, Zil Katle L'Panya, go kill X, V'lo Katin Olach, if not, I'm going to kill you. Right, so apparently he's asking the Shaila to Rabba. Really, that's much more fun if you think he's asking the Shaila to Rabba, because Rabba is the one he's supposed to kill. Right. But no evidence one way or the other. Okay, Rabba says, Lekadlech velo tiktol, let them kill you and let you not kill. Mi yemer de dama didach sumak tfe, dilma dama de hau gavra, And who says that your blood is redder? Maybe that person's blood is redder. And that seems to be the expression of the Svara. And who says that your blood is red? Okay, other versions of it. That's why I gave you the Gemara Yuma, right? The Gemara Yuma has, instead of Miyamar, has my chazi. Right, what have you seen as opposed to who would say? Okay, so the huge question here is this an unanswerable rhetorical question in general? Or is it just a default? Right, what happens if I can say, well, my blood is redder because I am smarter. My blood is redder because I'm a better athlete. My blood is redder because I have yichus. Right? My blood is, all those sorts of things. I am going to argue that we should treat it as an unanswerable question. There is nothing you can say that makes your that would make your blood redder than somebody else. I think that's the only way that you can. I think the simple read of the sugya, that there are no exceptions. And I want to argue that I'm going to try to argue that this svara, which we don't have framed as an abstraction, right? We have framed as as a down home folk, right? Folk statement. Exactly right. That actually it is intended to encode Kant's categorical imperative. That what we mean by who says your blood is redder is you can't treat somebody else as a means, which would put one person over another. If one person becomes an end, one person becomes a means. Okay, right. So that's my big move. Right, is my attempt, is my argument that this is the place where Kant is Kant is simply channeling the tradition, and I'm going to claim like it's a straight line, right? Selam Elokim, my chazed damidach sumak tvei, categorical imperative. And there are three contexts in which the Gemara quotes, the three contexts from which the Gemara gets to this point of Rasef Gufei Minolan. So the first one we saw, Rav Yochanan Yosedek, is the question of what's Yehara Gvali Avor. The second one in Yuma is the question of whether you can eat on Yom Kippur. That's about whether you can save yourself by doing an Avera. And the conclusion is, by Kol Midrapi in Chutz, the conclusion is that you can feed a pregnant woman who appears to be in danger on Yom Kippur, because nothing stands in front of Pikuach Nefesh, Chutz Me'avodah Zarah Gilui Raya V'Shfichut Damim. Okay, so you have to figure out whether that line, Pikuach Nefesh, is significant or not. And the last context is Ravin, also quoting Rabbi Yochanan again, who says, Bakol Midrapin. So there are three contexts. One is, right, one says, just generally, if you're under duress, should you resist the duress and get yourself killed? The answer is no, except for these three things. The second is if you're experiencing a natural or a risk of a risk of natural death, should you like, you know, if you're hungry, right? So can you do to keep yourself alive? Then there's a specific case. What happens if you're sick? Not that you have a lack, but there's something actively toward, going to kill you. Are you allowed to violate right to violate lach? And we perhaps will see next week that each of these, there are always Havaminas trying to argue that they're different, that the results are different in each of these cases. For example, the Rambam says that if you if somebody threatens and says, "I'll kill you if you don't eat that piece of ham," and right, sorry, "I'll kill you if you don't violate avodah zarah," and you violate avodah zarah, the Rambam says that even though you should have died, we treat you as anus. But if you heal yourself by avodah zarah, the Rambam says that we give you the appropriate punishment. So even though the halachas come to the same place, right, the Rambam doesn't yield the same outcome. It depends on what the pressure is, and then you can try and figure out whether Uber Sheiricha is the same case or a third case. We should be aware of all that. But the core argument I'm trying to make is that this statement is an attempt to encode Kant's principle, and I'm going to try to argue that understanding it that way has nafkaminas halachically. Right? The simplest thing is that it becomes, because the categorical imperative is that it doesn't allow for exceptions.
So on the face of things, how is Nitan Lahatzilo Benafsho not an exception?
Very good. Next page. Oh. Right. Very good. Next page. Right. But it's not just a problem with exception for Kant. It's a problem with the Svara.
Yes.
Okay. Right. So there are a series of exceptions to the apparent exceptions to what the Gemara claims is a prior svara. And like I said, this is one of my big speeches. I try to all my students that the chop of the svara, the key thing is that it's not a svara you derive from Torah, it's a svara you have to know before you read Torah. Because you can't interpret the Hekesh until you have the svara. Right? So people ask, like, you know, aren't all your ethics supposed to come from Torah? Well, no. You get Torah wrong unless you already have this svara. So you can claim, no, we get this from somewhere else. Oh, good, where? So it's all okay, right? Right. So we're back to the same place. Okay. So the first exception is the famous debate between Ben Patur and Bekiva, two people walking in the desert, and one of them is holding a canteen of water. They both drink. They both die. One of them drinks. That person makes it to civilization. Ben Patur says, better for both of them to drink and both of them to die, and let neither of them see the death of his fellow. Right, that's what Vitara is like, right? Mutav sheishtushnehem yimutu, let both, better for both of them to drink and both die, and let not one of them see the death of their friend. So that seems like a very nice encoding of who says your blood is better than anybody else's. Extending it, right? Extending it even in another way. Ad sheba Rabbi Akiva, Billy Maid, Rabbi Akiva comes along and says, v'chei achicha imach, Chayecha kod bin l'chayechicha. Right? The chayechicha only happens if your achicha is going to be imach. If you're not going to be there, then the chayechicha goes away. So that seems like an explicit contradiction to the svara. Right? Stark, right? Your life comes first. You get to drink the water. So we'll have to try and figure out, you know, first of all, we have to try halachically. How do we, on the one hand, say the svara yields a generation you can't kill, but you're allowed to drink even though that causes someone else to die? What's the difference between killing somebody and causing someone else to die in a way which is consistent with the svara? Because if you say it's the chomer avera, then we need the svara, right? And then everybody's going to play games in terms of what happens if the person holding the water owns the water, right? Does that make it right? If you have to steal it, is that different? Right? Maybe you're allowed to drink the water only right? Only if the person is holding water which is neutral, maybe only if they're holding water that belongs to you, right? What sort of odds are necessary to figure out if the person making it to the yeshiva, right? All sorts of things like that. But the bottom line is, On the one hand, there's a pasuk contradicting a svara. On the other hand, they were willing to advance the svara as self-evident, even though they knew the drasha. Right, that's it, right. That's it, like, it makes it even stronger. Right, they could make a claim like this, even though they know that the drasha says v'chei achichem lach. So that seems to say, obviously, you can kill somebody to save your life. No, it's a svara. That svara applies perfectly well, you know, just as well to the water case. Okay. Right. So the second thing that that seems to be a challenge is the mission and the whole sugi of Horiot, which begins at ish kodim leisha lachayot. So that does not seem like a you could easily argue that many, if not all, of the lists of priorities in this sugya, and if you look at the Abba, the Gemara, even though there's a whole list of, let's say, of Kohanim, which seems like to be that they could just be about right about feeding or honor or avoiding tuma, and the end of the Gemara says Kitanya Hayu Lahu Lachioto. No, those are all about Lachiot also. So that also seems to that challenges the claim that the svara is unanswerable. But really, you know, the way the story should read is a man came to Rabbah and said, "The Lord of my manor said, I will kill you if you don't kill him. What should I do?" And Rabbah should have said, "Well, are you a Kohen? Is he a Kohen? Right? Let's have a test and see who's a bigger Talmud Chacham." Right? And this way you have to like train it, which I think is absurd, but you can really say, right, Rabbah is saying, well, what have you seen that makes your blood redder than his? And we don't know what the end of the story is. The end of the story could be he kills him. Because he has lots of reasons his blood is redder. I much prefer, I'm shot even before having any content commitments, to think that Rabbah, you know, I think it's very clearly shot, but that's just an only a dangerous thing to say, that the implication is that Rabbah is telling him not to kill the person, and not because Rabbah has intimate knowledge of both parties and knows that neither of them has any basis for claiming their for claiming priority. But so there are ways around it. You know that Rabbi Rachman pointed out that there is no halachic code that interprets lachayot as actually saving somebody who's drowning before the other person. It's all about how you distribute scarce resources. And lachiyot doesn't mean that they're actually in immediate danger of death, right? All sorts of ways which you can take this sugya and move it into realms where it doesn't relate to the kind of extreme circumstance that the sugya is talking about. You can think that mamzer talmud chacham kodem lekohen go l'am aretz means it's a way of restoring the default that there's no way to know. You have to know everyone perfectly. And right, because whatever every person may have some merit that makes them have redder blood. So instead of framing it, but that's a different kind of argument than the content argument is that human beings are intrinsically equal, and no matter what you knew, you would still treat them as equal. Right, that kind of argument would be right. You can't know which human being is greater than the others. So you have to treat them as if they were equal. So I'm much happier going with the no, they're equal. Yes, sir.
When said by Talmidei Chachamim, which one has to suppose it was, more of a assertion of value of the person talking than an assertion that everyone has the same value?
Say it again.
Is it in the Mamzer Chachamim Kodem was? Yeah.
It's in the same line. So right, they created the hierarchy and they overturn it. You can set up a temp. You can set up a temp. You can claim that it's a political reaction. You could claim if you want, but the Mishnah itself just states it this way. Mishnah itself just states it this way. Okay, we're talking about, you know, that there's the Mishnah has a long list, right? That there are other Right? What about the other people on the list? Right? I've claimed that the mayor's statement, mayor puts right puts Garam as a statement that puts Garam. Okay, that's right. There is our right. So there is our fundamental problem. Right? We have what the Gemara claims is the fundamental svara, and we have two exceptions that we care to it. Right? And there's a third. In the third case of Rode, right? Which is due to you already mentioned that, right? If somebody's trying to kill you, you can kill them, right? You can kill them. So how is that, right? How is that? Why don't we say in terms of Rodev that what lets you choose your life over somebody else? What lets you choose one person's life over another? So the answer is, well, there's a mitzvah. Okay, but that mitzvah existed before they said the svara. Right? Why doesn't the mitzvah undo the svara? Right? So the challenge in terms of figuring out in terms of Chazal is what made it legitimate for them to pose this svara as self-evident in despite the biblical evidence, and how you handle the counter biblical evidence, right? So you can cheat and just say, well, that's the svara, and all those are just zeros and kusses. It doesn't change the svara, right? We just treat this as intuitive. That's weaker than trying to find a way to make it all compatible with the svara. And the question, but the ways to make it compatible with the svara may not be make me philosophically happy, because they may not be compatible, right, with the notion that we're framing it in terms of the intrinsic worth of every human being, right? So that's the challenge. Okay. So one of the cases which came up, right? We have 5 minutes. I'll just try to. One of the cases where this came up for me was when the question of triaging ventilators for COVID came up. Right. So, what should the principle of triaging, how should we decide to triage ventilators? And there were arguments. There are all sorts of arguments as to how you could decide. There was an argument for first responders, that we should, right, and medical professionals, that they should go first. And there are two kinds of arguments for that. One kind of argument, which was that because they're putting themselves at risk, therefore they get it first. And a second argument was that it's better for everyone's overall health if they get it first. So I argued that the second argument was admissible Jewishly, whether it's true or not, and the first argument was inadmissible. Right, the claim that you can choose one person's life over another because they have a particular virtue, right, that seemed to me to be a fundamental violation of my Chazad Dami Dach Samok Shvei. Yes, Deborah.
Is that a claim of virtue, or is it a claim that people won't be willing to do it to begin with if they don't think that they'll get preference? Maybe it's more like Ramosha saying that the Hatzalah guys can drive home on Shabbos, because otherwise no one will want to be on
Hatzalah. Yeah, so you could frame it, right? It's not, you know, that it's not, that the best situation would be if they did it anyway, but this is incentivizing them. Right? I tended to think that was also out of balance, because that would be giving into what I saw as a fundamental violation of ethics, so allowing some people to prefer their lives to others. Right, so I took the svara. I started from the svara, said when we as a community are allocating resources, the first premise when we're allocating resources has to be that all life is equal. So there was a second thing. There was a line in a tshuva attributed to Rav Hirschel Schechter, which was understood as saying that you could give young people ventilators before older people, because younger people will live longer. I thought that was also a fundamental violation of Jewish ethics, because right, that you could just measure the value of life by quantity, and not maybe we could talk about Chai Shah versus Chai Ola, maybe. But this is not Chai Shal Chai Olam. This is 10 years versus 70 years, things like that. When I sent that feedback, I was told that that had not been the intent and the trivia was edited. Right, so at this point, there is happily no Posick on record denying that that would be a violation of the fundamental Jewish ethics. I can't tell you what the original trivia originally meant. So there was a second way, right, in which we, but then the problem is, but what about if the argument is not about, about who will, right, whose natural life will live longer? The argument is about for whom will medical care be more efficacious? Like one person has a 30% chance that, again, that was when we thought ventilators really helped, right? Which is the whole, right? In retrospect, right? You know, it might be that putting people in the proper position was more helpful, right? But at that point, the givens of the circumstance were that we thought that people would be more likely to survive in ventilators. And then we thought we could have criteria as to which people would be more likely to help by ventilators. So I think it's obvious that people who are not helped by ventilators are that silly. The question is, what about you know, some people being helped, some people being helped less, and some people being helped more? Right, that's it, right. Do you still have to end up saying that no, it has to be completely in the order in which people come in, because anything other than treating cases as they come in is a violation of this principle? Or are we willing to say that there's some way in which allocation of resources can take place in a way which doesn't violate this FAR? Right, optimal allocation of resources doesn't violate this FAR. Right, that's a tricky thing. So I'll start with this, right? Then we'll pick this up. We'll pick this up next week. The question is, let's see if I can frame it right. So Ben Pitora says, right, Ben Pitora's position is that they both drink the water and they both, right, and they both die. Why does Ben Pitora end that position? So the way Rav Chaim Soloveitchik understood this was, well, I have to give you the water because I'm not allowed to drink it, because that would be preferring my life to yours. So I give you the water. Okay, what do you do now? You can't drink it, right? So you give me the water. So the question is, why does either of them get to drink the water? Why shouldn't they both die without drinking the water? And my chazit doesn't always yield intuitive results. So we'll have to figure out, you know, the challenges are, like, does my chazit apply if it's one person versus two people? Right, that's the whole question about whether all infinites are equal or not, right? All infinites have infinite value, right? So the two infinites have greater value than one infinite. Right, I was telling the story that many years ago, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg got up and gave a speech at a federation meeting, or some sort, in which he said that he couldn't deal with a particular aspect of halacha because it implied that some, you know, because all human beings are of infinite value, and it's implied that Jews have more value than others. And although I take that position, but being a, you know, lachisnik, I raised my hand and I said, but you can hold all human beings are infinite, but not all, right? But some infinites are more, are greater than others. And at that point, it's like everyone in the room fell asleep. No interest whatsoever in exploring the question of whether we should acknowledge the possibility of different infinite values of human beings, though human beings are infinite value. The question is, why does, granting that my chazit will sometimes yield results that are not as balabatishly intuitive, as this far, which is, again, we left the story. The story is framed balabatishly, right? Not philosophically. Why doesn't, according to Rav Chaim asks, why doesn't Ben Pitora say they should both die without drinking the water? And his answer is that would be ridiculous.
Shouldn't they both wait until someone dies and then the other one can drink all
it could be that you're still recoverable at that point, right? Presumably, whoever died, right? That's also a really good idea. I haven't heard that question before. Thank you. That is not a question. That is not a question I had thought. I had thought of like, what if you just wait? One of you might die fast. Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Doesn't come up in Ruchayim, I know. It's really doesn't even come up in Chaznish, so far as I know. Really interesting. But let's work for now within Rav Chaim. Rav Chaim says that would be ridiculous. So they both drink because obviously letting them both drink is a better outcome, rather than living longer, is a better outcome than both of them dying sooner. So I wanted to argue that there may be some kind of principle built into my chazit which says when the result of my chazit is ridiculous, right? Then right, the result of treating as a formal principle is ridiculous, then you can do better. And so what I tried to work out was a way in which allowing the rational allocation of medical efficacy, not of age, right, but of medical efficacy, right, was equivalent of allowing both people to drink, and wasn't a violation of the svara, because it wasn't related to the value of the people. Right, your allocation was not grounded on some, right, this I want to help this person as much as that. It's just I can help this person more. So I think that's the move one has to make in lots of cases, is to try and say, look, we're not interested in equality of outcomes per se. We're interested in equality of treatment. And if we're saying, look, we treat everybody equally, and that equal person, we give you access to medication based on the odds that you will be helped by this medication, which has nothing to do with your value. And that's a Kantian move, right? Because if I just framed it in terms of the Isser, or my or who says your brother's better, I might have the same problem. But if I say that it's okay to treat some people differently than others, so long as that treatment doesn't imply anything about value, then we have a lot more space. Right? That's the first nafkamina to thinking about this principle in a philosophic way, which doesn't move us very much, or it doesn't introduce the means ends distinction, right? The much bigger move is going to be introduced the means ends distinction as an expression of value. But to start off by saying that really understands it as who says your blood is red, or is not an internal halachic claim. It's a claim that says, right, you're not allowed to do things that express a claim that your being has more value than the other person's being. And if we end up with unequal treatment, but is grounded in a commitment to all blood being equally red, then we're fine. Okay, so that's the first way. If you have a nafkamina, and the nafkamina, right, which comes out of all of these as well. We didn't talk about, which we'll talk about next time, that, you know, the challenge. But in fact, Ben Shmuel Lakim, I didn't talk about how Jews and non-Jews play into this. Again, my commitment is going to be that you can't ontologically privilege Jews over. You can't say Jewish life is more valuable than non-Jewish life. And the question is, can you, right? Does that fit into halacha well or not? And what are the nafkaminas, and how do we handle those nafkaminas? All right. Thank you very much for leaning into intellectualism. And we'll pick it up with a whole list of I think probably aside from my trying to sharpen the triage thing, we'll talk about brain death, which is the first place where I really use this with the Nachmina Halacha, and then there are four or five other cases where I played out.